Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome back to Your Own Personal Beatles. My name is Jack Pelling.
And I'm Robin Allender.
And we're here for Series 2, which is very exciting.
It's nice to be back. I feel like we're maybe slightly more prepared for this series.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely got more in the bank. We know what we're doing. We've learned a lot, filled in a few gaps in the old Beatles knowledge.
When I look back to Series 1, I can't quite get my head around the unbelievable hubris, which I realise I can't really pronounce, which is quite hubristic in itself. Hubris?
Hubris, yeah. Hubris.
Starting a Beatles podcast with, you know, let's not say an encyclopedic knowledge of the Beatles, but certainly with a passion for the Beatles.
Yeah, we've learned a lot. We've come a long way. Let's learn more.
It's good. I think what listening back to the episodes of the first series and listening to some of the things we've recorded for this series, I think it's just it's been great to go through and realize that, you know, it's basically a podcast about music and about discoveries of music, and because the Beatles are so universal, that's the starting off point. And I think we've had some really good chats.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. You know, we got some amazing people lined up. We won't give them all away, but yeah, certainly some. It never ceases to amaze just how much gold there is in people's formative experiences with the Beatles and beyond, really. So really excited for everyone to sort of get cracking with this. We're up first with the band Field Music, who are sort of Sunderland art rock band, David and Peter Brewis. We recorded a fantastic episode with them a couple of months ago now. This is a cracking one.
Yeah, it's great. Some really good chats. And they were also doing, before their new album came out, a podcast, which was kind of releasing a song from the album and then going through kind of songs that influenced it. So that's a really good kind of counterpoint to this episode, I think, because they talk about It's All Too Much in the Beatles song. And that was kind of what made me message them on Twitter about getting them on the show.
Yeah, and they talk about music in such a brilliant way. They're absolutely fantastic guys. They're really sort of, you know, the joy really comes across. They've got a real love of the art form and the process of making music. Listening to their Field Music cast, which is what it's called, has actually got me writing music myself again for the first time in quite a few years.
Wow.
So, you know, it just reignited the sort of the spark of passion for the process rather than, getting annoyed at myself and beating myself up over things, which is the way I usually write.
Yeah.
It's really fantastic. So check that out. Their new album, Flat White Moon, came out about a month ago, and it's absolutely fantastic. You'll see some snippets of it in this podcast, which we've got kind permission from Memphis Industries to show you a bit of. But check that out. Really brilliant album. It's a great show.
Yeah. I've got a few things I wanted to clear up before the show.
Sure.
We had a really interesting chat. We had a good chat, a lot of chats about Beatles singles and about the Red and Blue albums, which come up a lot. Mm-hmm. So Red and Blue albums, if you've got a bit of spare time, read the Wikipedia page because it's really interesting. So they were put together by Alan Klein.
Yeah.
Which is why maybe some of the choices are a bit weird. But did you know the Spanish edition of the Blue album doesn't have the Ballad of John and Yoko on it?
Well, I didn't until you texted me that yesterday.
You could pretend I was telling you for the first time.
surely not. Why?
Because of Gibraltar. We also talked about, we're talking about the singles, and Rubber Soul, there were no singles released from Rubber Soul in the UK or the US, which is really interesting because some of those songs are so well known. Well, obviously, because it's on Rubber Soul and because the Beatles are well known. But it's probably partially because of their overrepresentation on the Red album, which was something we talk about, which I found that quite interesting. Other singles we were talking about, we talked about, so Peter and David talked about this kind of Dylan-esque way of singing, of writing songs where you kind of have verse, 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 or a verse with a kind of tagline of a chorus on it.
Yeah.
And we were trying to think of a Beatles song that does that. And I realised after listening to it that a good example is We Can Work It Out, which is obviously it's verse, and then the chorus is kind of the end of the verse. So that's kind of, obviously there's a big Dylan influence there. But it's funny because there was a really good article in the paper the other day. You know, The Guardian does their How We Made.
Yeah, yeah.
And they did one about the Bangles' Eternal Flame. And Billy Steinberg, who wrote the song, said Eternal Flame was retro in that it has no chorus. It's structured like an old Beatles song with the title tagged onto the end of the verse. Am I only dreaming, or is this burning an eternal flame? So, and he mentions We Can Work It Out there as well. So I thought that was an interesting comparison.
That's a crossover I've never, can't say I've ever noticed before.
But I think that was it.
So we won't keep you much longer. We've had some amazing correspondence while we've been away, which has been fantastic. And we do read it all. We're not going to delve into it now. But if you want to get in touch and share your personal Beatles with us, you can email me at jack@homespunsounds.com, or you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact. But I'll just read one out that was really lovely, and I was just searching through them, and this one jumped out at me. I remember getting this a few weeks ago, so I thought I'd read it to you because I don't think you've read this one either. But it says, "Dear Jack and Robin, I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed your own personal Beatles. I listen to it most mornings as I walk to school in the Kenyan sunshine. I teach history at an international school in Nairobi. The podcast has made me revisit all the albums I grew up with and helped me discover more. I love hearing your discussions, and you both have taught me a lot, including the word tangential," which is a very apt word for this podcast. Two things I wanted to share. My own personal Beatles is listening to the Red Album and Sergeant Pepper Round and Round as a child whilst on family holidays in Normandy, where we went every year. My mum and dad in the front, and myself, my brother and sister in the back, belting out Help. In fact, we listen so much that I associate the music, especially the Red Album, with that place. I was thinking about associating the Beatles' music to a specific location and had an idea. The one album I never got around to was the White Album. When I was young, I think I found it too weird. Your podcast inspired me to write that wrong. I've been listening to it on repeat in my car driving around Kenya, and now I love it. I'm moving to Cairo in August, so I thought I'd build an association with the White Album in Kenya. So when I listen to it, I always think of this magical country. My Kenyan girlfriend, who had never listened to the Beatles, only likes one song. You've guessed it, Obladi Oblada. Secondly, the Beatles' music connects me to my mum, who I lost suddenly in 2019. By remembering family holidays and listening to their voices, I feel closer to her. In the process of my listening to the White Album, I've heard songs like Julia for the first time, which I found incredibly moving and helped me. Thanks again for your podcast. I found it healing and soothing during these uncertain times. Warm regards, Hugh Bradbury in Nairobi, Kenya. So that's, what a lovely email.
Thank you, Hugh.
Very touching. And thanks very much for sharing it. So, do send them in if you want to get in touch with us. And we read them all, and we read out as many as we can. One other thing to mention is, for this series, we've got a Patreon. So if you want to hear ad-free extended versions of every episode, is usually about sort of an extra 10 or 15 minutes at least, then you can sign up to that. And for the minimum amount we could charge you, you'll get all of those episodes, plus some bonus monthly episodes that are exclusive to your Patreon feed, which should be really fun.
Yeah, the monthly episodes are going to be kind of, we're going to have some kind of rambly chats ourselves, me and Jack. We're going to revisit certain albums and films potentially, and maybe even try to kind of talk about the songwriting as well, in terms of working out some of the songs, seeing if we can find some secrets that way. So join us for the monthly podcast.
Yeah, and we might have a few old faces from series one pop up on it, and there'll be loads of really fun stuff, so do get involved with that if you can. In the meantime, you can follow us on all the social media accounts at Personal Beatles on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all of that sort of good stuff. But we won't keep you any longer. Please sit back, relax, and listen to excuse me, I've got COVID-19. This is Field Music on your own personal Beatles.
Excuse me, I've got COVID-19.
Sad but true.
On this week's Your Own Personal Beatles, we're delighted to welcome David and Peter Brewis from the band Field Music. Field Music emerged during the mid-noughties, but landfill indie they are not. Is that okay? Is that fair?
That's absolutely fair.
I would say we were.
You were?
No, not really.
Not really. Along with their northeastern contemporaries and friends, Maximo Park and the Futureheads, Field Music brought a more sophisticated and artful edge to the guitar pop of the time and have continued to develop over the course of 8 albums and numerous side projects. For me, I love Field Music because they're one of those bands like Tortoise, I think, where you can hear that they're huge music lovers, and Magpie-like, you can pick up influences from the Beatles to Squeeze to Prince to Joni Mitchell. All artists that tend to be respected for their craft and sophistication, and as a Field Music album title suggests, measure. Their material is very measured, and I've often thought of Field Music as the least sloppy band of all time. So without further ado, welcome to Field Music's Own Personal Beatles.
Thanks
for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. How was that? Was that fair? Is that fair, do you think, as an intro?
I mean, I feel that we are quite sloppy, much
really?
Sloppier than people realise.
Right.
And I don't think...
So say the tempo maps, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of the things which bands do in order to sound tight, we don't do. So we try and avoid playing the clicks. As
really?
Ringo, as well, Ringo said, he
I'm
is
the fucking
the click.
Click. Oh, sorry,
Ringo is the click. Yeah.
All the kind of like the editing of your drums to make them in time and doing like we try and avoid all right. of that and basically record in, even though we record on computers, for the most part we record in a very traditional way, in part because we are such Beatles nerds, and we learned to record on a 4-track cassette machine and wondered through those years, why don't our recordings sound as good as the Beatles? They were recording on 4-track. I've seen George Martin say so on the Beatles anthology.
Yeah.
What we didn't realise was our microphones were terrible. A cassette 4-track is in no way equal to the top of the line 4-track 2-inch tape recorders they were using at the time.
Yeah, and I had this confusion I remember with cassettes.
Yeah,
thought,
you just
sound really?
Yeah, my Yamaha MT3X should do exactly what the custom built EMI tape recorder should be able to do.
Jeff Emmerich tinkering around you while you're
a whole team of engineers making
in
sure
white
they
coats and
that they run exactly as they should. And of course, as performers and singers and songwriters, we were 13, 14, 15 year olds and not quite there.
Wow.
Nowhere near there.
Do you still record to, do you record to tape now? Have you tried to make your studio analog, or is it kind of?
No, because we don't have that team of engineers in the background making sure that everything works. And even though we've taken on a great deal of the kind of like the technical aspects of making records, you do get to the point where it's just like, I don't want to have to know any more of this because we want to make music. We want to write songs and record. There's only so much time that I would want to spend like aligning a tape machine or cleaning tape.
Yes, of course.
We've already done more of that than I ever felt kind of comfortable with. So computers are very, very convenient.
Yeah.
There must be a reason why everyone uses them.
Yeah. Quite very cheap and convenient comparatively.
Yeah, so you are admittedly sloppier than you might think, but I suppose what I'm saying in my intro then is that there's a kind of a real craft to your songwriting that I think is very measured and shows the kind of thought process behind it. And so for me, I can hear a big Beatles influence in that, as well as lots of other bands. But I mean, does that slightly make more sense then in terms of, do you feel the way you approach songwriting as being kind of precise in that kind of way? Is that a bit of a vague question?
I think maybe we are conceptually quite precise. But that just means that I think we have a very an idea about how we're going to approach something. I don't necessarily think we're very good at playing in time or playing in tune or writing the greatest structured songs in the world.
Or particularly knowing what we're doing, even. But conceptually... Wow.
And I think we're lucky because I think when me and Dave play out of time or out of tune or anything like that, we tend to do it together. And I think maybe we're fairly decent listeners, at least to each other, maybe not to anybody else, but at least to each other.
Right. You kind of got the brotherly Wilson brothers locking into each other kind of thing.
Maybe not that good, but...
I feel like I might be almost as good a drummer as Dennis Wilson.
That's great.
You mentioned that was your sort of formative recording influences, Beatles records, but how far back does it go for you two growing up? Where does your Beatles journey begin?
In the house, our mum and dad had Let It Be. And they also had a copy of Sgt. Pepper's that was scratched to hell inside. No,
we didn't really know about
it at the time. It was hidden.
We mainly listened to the Red and the Blue album. And that was on every week at least, you know, kind of it was just
And we
on.
Also had that experience where it's like our Uncle John had it on cassette, stuck in the car with him for a long drive, and he'd do that thing where you change the balance from left to right and you could hear different things. And I was absolutely blown away by that and still am to a degree. I'm at the stage now where it's like, the mono versions are probably the best of most of these. It was really what the guys intended. But I still like listening to the kind of imbalanced stereo versions where you're like, the bass in the right speaker. I'm just going to listen to the bass. I'm going to listen to Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I'm just going to listen to the bass in the right speaker.
Yeah, I mean, if those are the versions you grow up with, you have a certain attachment with them, don't you? Definitely.
Yeah. So what's the age difference between you guys?
Nearly 3 years.
Right, okay. But did you always have pretty similar music tastes then?
For the most part. I mean, there's certain things that Peter's more interested in than I, or the things that we've gotten into at different times, but there's nothing that Peter listens to where I think that is awful. I can't believe you like that. I haven't had.
I'll test you on that one, Dave.
But the Beatles was always a great unifier, I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think maybe the Beatles kind of continued to be a unifier throughout, really, because I think I think. You know, we kind of come back around to the Beatles again and again, maybe even at different times, you know, where I'll go through a kind of a slightly obsessive stage and Dave might, and it might be about different things, but we kind of, sometimes we align.
I think Plum is one of my favourite albums of yours, and I often think the first few tracks of that where it's kind of the songs almost seep into each other, there's something very kind of day in the life-y maybe about that, where it's kind of, you know, there's different sections or different moods, different pieces kind of blending together. Do you think that's a kind of, was that an influence or was there?
There's a big slice of Abbey Road side too, all across the
Right.
Plum.
Yeah, really. Yeah, yeah.
The idea that you're going to take smaller bits of songs that aren't going to turn into a full 3.5 minute first chorus, first chorus, bridge, first chorus, chorus kind of structure. And you say, let's find an interesting way of slotting them together.
And
Plum was absolutely informed by, you know, how that works on Abbey Road, especially.
Yeah,
yeah, that's great. And when I first sort of wrote to you on Twitter about asking you if you'd be interested in coming on this podcast, one of you said that basically your whole career has been trying to emulate Happiness is a Warm Gun. So is that kind of?
I think we've both said that a lot of times. Right.
So, but that's a song where it's kind of different parts, different kind of a very strangely structured song. And is that, I mean, how do you want to unpack that? Why that song particularly for field music?
So for a period, me and Peter were doing different bands because we found it so difficult to make decisions together. And frankly, we still do. But we found a way around it. But, you know, from the years like 1999 through to the end of 2003, we were doing two separate bands, quite often with exactly the same people in.
Right, yeah.
But just like, but this is the one where I get to say what goes, and that's the one where you decide what's going on. And at some point, you know, there's that realization or acceptance, everybody's right, we should just do a band together. But it's okay, we can make it like the Beatles, where, you know, it's, or like, you know, like the White Album, where it's like, oh, it's Paul's songs, or it's John's songs, or it's George's songs. And they act as each other's backing band.
Yeah.
And the first song that we started doing, knowing that it was going to be a part of this album, we didn't even have a band name at the time, but that was going to be part of this album, was a song called Shorter, Shorter, which is a very short song. Certain elements of it, like, you know, the underlying chords are fairly simple, really. The melody's fairly simple. But we thought, we'll sit down together and we'll arrange it together to make the most things happen possible.
Right.
The most interesting. There's going to be no repetition. Every section is going to do something different, like Happiness is a Warm Gun.
I was counting the days and I was counting the reasons I was satisfied. Everything is fine. You should never count. Shorter, shorter. Never be sure. Shorter, shorter, it's easy here. You can get it all. You can never be sure.
That, to a degree, set the template for how we were going to approach making the first album. I mean, we did it very inexpertly.
Right.
But Happiness is a Warm Gun was the starting point. And we've both said, like, a bunch of times, one of the things about the Beatles is they made lots of songs where you could treat that song as the start of a whole genre if you wanted to.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that no one's made a genre out of Happiness is a Warm Gun yet. So we're going to start a genre of music which stems off from that song.
Yeah.
Is that daft, Peter?
No, I think that's fair, really. I think because I think the other thing we were thinking of, let's just do normal instruments. Let's not make it sonically adventurous. Mm. Let's have the interest in the structure. And and I think that was a kind of a theme for the first record. You know, I think a lot of people saw experimental pop music as being something that was kind of... And, you know, and that's fine, and it can be as well, but I think we were just reacting against this idea of the experiment being in the sonic...
Right.
Rather than, and we wanted it to be in the structure.
Yeah, that's a brilliant way of putting it. Yeah, and has that kind of been something that's still part of your process? Because I think as your music's developed, I think with an album like Common Time and with the stuff that you've been releasing from your new album, it seems like it's more often can be based around maybe a loop or over the same kind of thing, and then kind of developing. I think the first time on Common Time is it all based around one thing, and then more instruments come in and it gets more layered and textured. So is that, are you still kind of, even when you're kind of basing a song on maybe one idea, you still have that Happiness is a Warm Gun idea of how can we make these sections different and stuff?
It comes back every now and again, doesn't it?
Mm.
I mean, there came a point where, like, me maybe more than Peter, I will allow myself to repeat things.
Yeah.
The second verse, it can be basically the same as the first verse, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Although every now and again, like, I think we'll both have that sense of like, nah, this is too much repetition. And you want to,
or it's not right for the material, you know. But you make those decisions pretty early on. It's like, I'm gonna make a song out over this riff that's just gonna go on constantly because I like it so much. I could hear it every single bar in this song and not get bored of it. As long as there are other things that are going to kind of come in and out around it that have some kind of counterpoint or have some kind of new texture or But I mean, you know, the Beatles did that as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Well, yeah, and Jack and I have been really enjoying your podcast, the Field Music Cast, and where you're kind of you're releasing a song from the album, and you're talking about the songs that kind of influence that. And so for the first one, Orion from the Street, you mentioned It's All Too Much.
Yeah.
From the Yellow Submarine soundtrack. And that's definitely an example of a song which is based around kind of drone.
Yeah.
But with a very, very interesting melody and very kind of beautiful melody, really.
Yeah, it's an amazing melody, sort of a kind of... It's very, very, very major, but also very, very strange.
Yeah, it jumps around a lot. And as a and as a record, there's just tons and tons of things that go on and seem to come in and out almost at random. But I think that was very much where they were at the time. It's like, okay, we've done Sgt. Pepper's and we've done all of this like ornate arrangement, but now we're quite possibly smoking a lot of weed and random is where it's at, and you know, you end up with all of the stuff that ends up on Magical Mystery Tour, and it's like, hey, random means George is just going to play the violin, and that's fine, because random man. I don't think
that's
Orion
how I feel.
I don't think Orion from the Street's that random.
Yeah, so you haven't kind of quite brought in those chaotic elements, but you're still kind of bringing it, or have you?
Well, we have to be George Martin as well as being.
Yeah, so I think we have to bring in the chaos and then also then rein it in, as well a bit. But I mean, you know, I would like us to kind of be able to be chaotic for a little bit longer and then rein it in almost at the last minute. And I think that's something I was trying to do with Orion from the Street,
right?
Whereby I had a drone that, you know, was through a delay pedal that I just. Really just improvised and then almost like just threw sort of these samples of other things onto the track that I thought might or might not work, but I just made sure that they all worked even when they weren't going to work. You know, it's like, okay, well, how do you make this work? How can you make it work? And it's and it was good fun, you know.
For that song as well, it kind of has that sort of more kind of ballad form where it's kind of verse, and
Then that's the kind of the maybe the more sort of Dylan or Tomorrow Never Knows sort of influence where you have a kind of refrain,
even if it's just a melodic refrain rather than a lyrical
refrain. It's just a melodic refrain or you're repeating something, and it's fine, you know. And I thought, we, you know, well, it was Dave's idea, you know, we should release this as a single, whatever that is. I was like, but it doesn't have a chorus and it doesn't have the elements that you meant to have.
Yeah.
And then obviously what we always think is, well, the Beatles did it.
Yeah.
You know, you can do, you know.
What's a good Beatles single without a chorus?
Oh, maybe they didn't do a single without a
chorus. This wasn't me putting you on the spot. I'm just like trying to think of a good one. I don't know. There must be one.
Must be one, yeah.
I mean, they have lots of songs where the hook is not necessarily the chorus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
I mean, like Penny Lane, the hook isn't the... Penny Lane,
The
hook is the first line of the verse.
I mean, does something have a chorus, or is the verse the chorus, or
no? It's got the sort of bridges, the chorus, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
It was very, it's interesting to hear you say that the verse of the Dylan thing is your approach to songwriting. Often that like premeditated, in that you were like, is that the original germ of the idea? I want to write something with loads of verses, like Stuck Inside of Memphis. Mobile with the Memphis Blues again.
With the Thesaurus Blues again. Sorry, the Thesaurus Blues.
Yeah, I can't say it.
Thesaurus Blues. That is a song idea that I am going to now take.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe. You know, I don't think we necessarily write the lyrics thinking about necessarily what the structure's going to be. Because I think me and Dave maybe do a lot the same thing. We kind of have notebooks full of words.
Mm. That's Google Docs for me now, mate. So, yeah.
But yeah. All right, 21st century boy. Yeah. I don't know. But I think because we're not the sort of people who just think that just things just happen, man, and they just kind of fall from the sky, and they just, I just had a dream and it came fully formed. Yeah. You know, we're fans of music, and we're fans of the structure of music, and and I think the Beatles were like that as well. I think they said, you know, like, I'm not saying that we're like the Beatles, but you know, this is a Beatles podcast, isn't it? So let's talk about them as well. Let's write a song like this. Let's write a Roy Orbison song. Let's write a Dylan song.
Was it Let It Be was going to be a kind of gospel, or was it Ray Charles he mentioned?
I think. So,
you know, I mean, that's why I love your podcast, because you're talking about, you know, specific songs that influence the songwriting. But I do also think, as you said, that's something the Beatles would have done themselves. Yeah, let's put a Dylan hat on.
Yeah, that's literally, kind of, you know, in John Lennon's case.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they would have found that really fun.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it probably kept them going.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, let's have fun. Let's try and do a
Shirelles,
you know, song. A song like this. Yeah, let's do a Shirelles. Let's do a...
I love that new... The stuff that's coming out in Stacks. We're going to do Stacks, you know, so we do Drive My Car. And, you know, like, what they did was actually, you know, you are bringing that really deliberate influence in, but also you bring in your entire life and everything you've ever heard.
Everything
about your personality in. So it can't be actually Stacks. No. And it becomes Drive My Car.
Yeah. And it can't actually
be the Shirelles. So it turns out to be like, it won't be long.
Yeah. Hmm. And Dylan did it again with the Beatles. That was the nice sort of circular thing of Blonde on Blonde and that sort of period as well, isn't it? It's like, is it Positively 4th Street that is like his version of Norwegian Wood?
It's fourth time around.
So, I suppose it's just nice to hear someone so candidly saying, like, yeah, this is what we were trying to achieve, rather than...
They were playing with each other, and it was all happening in such a short period of time. I think one of the things which maybe, like, has lessened to a huge degree is that the to and fro in the charts... Now you don't get like answer songs anymore, but these people were playing out there in like their entire careers, album after album after album, in the space of 2 or 3 years.
The other great one as well is that with Dylan is Karina, isn't it? And Your Bird Can Sing, which is that's a lovely.
I never thought about that one actually.
Yeah, you've got a bird that can sing, and
you got a bird. Yeah, nice.
But that's true, isn't it? Everything was coming out so quickly. I mean, there's such a frenzy of releases in the 60s. Everything seemed to speed up, that it was kind of, there were kind of answer records and responses.
Slightly off the path of the Beatles, although there is
feel
a time.
Free one do one feel yeah. free to one.
I've been really getting into an album called Donny Hathaway Live. And I think it was released in 1972. Really great soul singer and keyboard player, played behind Aretha Franklin and you know, lots of other people on Atlantic. But on that record, he plays a brilliant version of Jealous Guy. And he plays What's Going On. And he plays You've Got a Friend. Now, nowadays, if you're going to release a live album with covers on, they probably wouldn't be contemporary covers. This album was released in 1972, or maybe even released in 1971. And all of the covers he played were from, you know, like released in the year preceding that. You know, he was playing contemporary songs. And I think that's something which doesn't happen in the same way now.
Is that a financial thing, do you think, as well?
I think it's just due to the nature of what live music is.
I think there's also the fact that we've had another sort of 50 years of music since then. And
there's more to choose from.
So, for instance, if you're going to do a cover now, it's like you've got 70 years of pop music to choose from now rather than, you know, 10.
I think, yeah, it's interesting, a lot of those sort of soul singers, I mean, definitely in the early 70s, I can think of quite a lot of examples of, is that Clarence Carter has got, like, Let It Be on his on patches and stuff like that. And
yeah, you cover it straight away.
Ray Charles was doing loads of them, yeah. You would think people would be quite sick of Let It Be by 1971.
Yeah. There is still a light shining over me. Shine until tomorrow. Let it be. I will wake up to the sound of music. Mother Mary comes to me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Speaking
words of wisdom, let it be. Have you done Beatles covers yourself, or is that... You started in covers band, yeah.
We used to do Drive My Car first.
Really rocked up though.
We rocked everything up, Dave. I think that was the idea of the band, wasn't it? Really,
that was our like unique selling point. It's like, hey, we're going to play songs you already know, slightly rocked up, only slightly though.
And we did Day in the Life. Day in the Life rocked up.
You did Day in the Life.
That's actually ambitious. I had to get an electroacoustic guitar just to play that song. It sounded terrible.
Yeah.
I just have this memory of playing Help in the school band and being completely confused about whether it was in swing or straight time. I think I played it completely straight and the drummer played it in swing.
I think that's the...
did it brilliantly then.
Yeah, so I think it's that classic Ringo shuffle, you know, it's just so quick.
Yeah, yeah.
It may as well be straight.
I mean, this is actually something that about the Beatles we talk about all the time, is like how much of their music is swung. And again, it's something which like it's disappeared to a degree. You find a little bit of swing in some R&B. But you don't hear much of it you don't hear a great deal of it like in the pop charts really.
Yeah.
Almost every song on Sgt. Pepper's, you know, this thing which we still see as a kind of modernist masterpiece.
Yeah.
It has an element of
swing to it.
That's really interesting.
I think the only song that I can think of that really doesn't have some kind of odd time thing going on is maybe the reprise at the end, the reprise at the end.
Kind of straight up.
That's why it sounds so unusual and sort of breakbeaty, because it is Ringo playing. As straight as Ringo plays.
Yeah.
But you're both drummers, if anyone who's seen you will know.
We both own the same drum kit. That's not the same thing.
Do you both hold Ringo in this similarly high regard from a sort of technical level as a drummer?
He's
got all the personality, really. He's just got a lot of personality.
Yeah, he's like the archetype parts drummer.
Yeah,
he's just not showing you all of his skills on the drums, although, you know, like, boy, the guy can, you know, do that shuffle really, really fast, and that's not easy to do.
Yeah.
You wonder how much of it is Paul telling him, you need to play this kind of part. And, you know, there's certain songs like Every Little Thing, where it's like, Ringo's not quite comfortable with this, and Paul has kind of, he's told him what to do, and it doesn't quite click. But the interplay of Paul, John and George saying it needs to be this kind of thing, and Ringo internalizing that and, you know, playing brilliantly, I think it kind of defines almost like, you know, what we think of as, you know, what a band should be.
That sort of, the arrangement always comes first, but the amount of restraint. I mean, I'm not a drummer, but if I ever have a drum kit anywhere near me, the chances of me doing something that's going to serve the song instead of just like having fun and showing off is absolutely silch. But I think there's
so much more to Ringo than just obviously than serving the song. You know, I mean, I think about Ringo a lot.
That's good because he doesn't get enough airtime on this podcast.
For what? Well, let's do it. The rest of the show. That's fine. And I mean, what one particular thing which Ringo does, and you probably know this already, that nobody else does in the world, you know, or it certainly didn't, because it was probably the wrong thing to do. He was a left-handed drummer playing right-handed.
Mm.
So he started all of his drum fills with his left hand.
Mm.
Hence why he didn't go doodle 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 doodle. He just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So that's why you get those kind of drum fills which sound almost backwards. You get that sort of. So when I found that out, I was like, wow. And I started practicing drum fills, starting with my left hand. Just so I could, like, you know, emulate that kind of. And it does give it a different kind of swing, and you end up not playing the drums in the tie in the order you're meant to play them in.
Yeah.
But why we got to this is because, you see, I'm left-handed. And I'm playing a right-handed kit. If there's any drummers in here, see, they usually go, you know, they go round the drum this way. Well, I can't do that. See, I can't go. So I have to get this hand down to roll. So that's why everyone thought, wow, he's a genius, but all he's doing is trying to play backwards. You know, so he goes, so it comes round this way, and all my fills, which, you know, they don't come in fast. There's always a break because I have to get this hand ready. So it's like. And get back, you know what I'm saying? So it's like one of those mad accidents. You can't learn it. I was left-handed. My grandmother didn't like that. She made me go right-handed. And so I have a right-handed kit, but actually I'm a left-handed player.
If any drummers want to, like, dive into how that feels, try and play the rhythm for Get Back, then watch them doing it on the rooftop, and you realize that Ringo is doing it with the hands the other way around.
And it sounds different how you would play it. And that's the other thing about Ringo, he always sound. I mean, it changed, obviously, when he started dampening the kit down a lot, but his drums always sounded great and almost, like, different every song. Sometimes, you know, the toms were tuned up really high.
Yeah.
Sometimes they were really low. Sometimes there was, you know, you could hear the dampening on various drums. But generally, the drums just always sound great.
Given how quick they were making a lot of those records, they must have put a lot of thought into it.
Because I rewatched Yellow Submarine the other day, I just noticed that the drumming on All You Need Is Love is really good as well. I mean, because he does like really, really good, you know, just the classic proper drum roll, which I can't do, you know, where it's kind of bouncing off the skin. And like, he doesn't do that very often, but he does it so well. You know, and it's weird to have that in your arsenal, but like, if I could do that really well, the kind of almost like tortoisey style drum, like jazz drumming, I'd just be doing it all the time, you know.
What else does he do it on?
There is another one. I can't remember what it is.
There's quite a marchy track on that record as well, isn't it? Is it Your Mother Should Know? Has that got a role in it?
Yeah, it might do. There is another one.
But George Martin always said that he couldn't roll to save his life, but I don't think that's necessarily true.
No.
It is interesting with Ringo and a lot of drummers of that era that We've been talking about this recently, like the difference between British and American drummers of that era. And my theory is that because we didn't have the kind of the Chitlin circuit where the gigging dance bands were actually playing R&B or, you know, proto soul, the drummers in the 60s English bands basically came straight out of like a big band version of what a dance band was.
Yes. Yeah,
straight from that into rock and roll and then and then on. So the style of drumming is
Pink Floyd route, wasn't it? That kind of came from that.
Well, I think people like
thing.
Mitch Mitchell are going to be, they're more sort of Ronnie Varel, John, you know, Gene Krupa, Buddy Rich drummers.
Straight out of the big bands into playing, into playing rock.
It's the sort of the band of gypsies swap over when you get the Buddy Miles coming in for Mitch Mitchell, and it's just like that British version thing. American sound. It's completely different.
Totally different. Yeah, yeah. Totally different. Yeah.
I love how there was a jazz magazine at the time, called Downbeat, which Philip Larkin subscribed to, which is great, because he was a jazz drummer, apparently. Anyway.
Really?
Oh, really?
There you go.
Yeah.
We've got our stock question that we ask everyone is, do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
I'm not sure whether this is controversial, but I think that Let It Be, the song, is underrated. And I think it's genuinely, you know, a really soulful bit of communication. And I think that While My Guitar Gently Weeps is still overrated, whereas for me, the best things about that are Paul's piano playing and Paul's back and vocals.
What about Eric?
Eric's fine, but I'd be all right without the guitar.
You'd rather Prince doing the solo.
that was over the top. I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rein in.
But that's, I think that's a, I mean, that's Let It Be. I think that's a great point, because Let It Be is one of those songs where it's so well known. Like, I mean, I think at school I thought it was like a hymn.
Yeah,
it can kind of catch you unawares, and I think when I listen to, you know, Let It Be Naked for the first time, I think it was then you sort of, oh my God, this song is amazing.
What a beautiful song.
Yeah.
But I think the Beatles also have like a load of songs where through familiarity you underrate their brilliance. So for instance, I've been singing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds to get my kids to sleep, you know, for the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And it might even be my favourite Beatles song.
Wow.
And I think it is absolutely complete in terms of musical construction and lyrics and
atmosphere.
It's
as
so
well
known. Yeah. I mean, it just, it does it all, but it's so well known. I think people like think, oh yeah, that's one of the famous ones, but you know, I'm going to listen to Getting Better, which is also great.
Well, maybe it's not a controversial opinion, but it's a fact, and I don't like it. But I think the Red album is massively flawed in terms of its song selection.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it is weighted so heavily to Rubber Soul that it means that there isn't a single song from Revolver on that album that wasn't a single. Yet from Rubber Soul, they're basically missed three songs out. And it's been good, because it made me, when I heard Revolver, I thought it was just, it was like a new band to me.
Yeah. It only has Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine.
Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine, which was a single. I think it was a double A side or a B side.
Yeah. And you tended to know that one before, regardless of whether you'd heard Revolver.
Yeah, you knew them both anyway, because one was on, they were both on Yellow Submarine, and one was a children's classic. Whereas from Rubber Soul, you have got Drive My Car, Norwegian Wood. In My Life, Girl.
Nowhere Man. Michelle.
And Michelle. And
yeah.
Were any of them singles? I don't know, but it's like who decided this?
Yeah, there are some odd situations. We've said this before about the Blue Album having Old Brown Shoe on it, which is quite
weird. I love Old Brown Shoe though.
Yeah, it's good, but it's like
it's better than good. Here's another controversial opinion.
Yeah,
that is my favorite sort of the late 60s. Well, maybe it's like the Abbey Road era,
right?
Beatles songs, I think.
Yeah.
Wow.
You said a very controversial one for me on the podcast, which was you prefer It's All Too Much to Blue Jay Way. Blue Jay Way is...
I didn't say that. I didn't say okay. Dave said that.
That was me. Yeah,
although I agree with Dave.
Really?
As well. I think All Too Much is amazing. But I do like Blue Jay Way. It's experimental music. Oh, it's
great tune. I love it.
I'm sure we'll get someone tweeting us to tell us the reason why the red and the blue were compiled in such a way, because there is always some weird reason to do with the way that they released in stereo or re-released on 8-track or something.
Or it might have been an American sort of the way that the albums were, because there's like
because Revolver was quite poorly dealt with in America, wasn't it?
Yeah, was that the one that they kept burning?
Well, they released it as The Butcher, with The Butcher cover, with like songs from that on it, and then it never came out and it's like proper form, so that could be another reason why.
Tell you what, while we're on the Red album, and this is controversial, I really don't like Can't Buy Me Love.
Get out of town. Crazy business.
Of all the early ones, I love so many of the early ones.
I think John's kind of very absent from that song, I feel.
Yeah.
Like, vocally, he's not on it, I don't think.
Yeah.
Or he seems very, very absent.
For me, that is one where, like, Paul's energy gives it everything it needs, and
gives it all it has.
Well, that's fine. That's enough. Paul McCartney's energy, I would basically swap for almost anything.
Yeah,
I would have his
even now. Even now.
And you could run a small country on it.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't even tried the, bagel with Marmite and hummus thing, but maybe that's the secret.
Have you seen him making mashed potato?
I have. I don't need his mashed potato energy.
There's a great bit of him making mashed potato with raw onion. What do you do, Paul?
With raw onion. This is disgusting.
You know how to peel a potato. You don't use a big knife like that. You use a potato peeler. I use a silly little knife like this. So let's say you're going to peel your spuds, and you're going to peel a whole panful.
He looks as though he's having a good time.
My kids really love Can't Buy Me Love, so I had to work out how to play it, and it was one of those where it's like, learning how to play this has given me even greater appreciation for what it is. So I'm a fan. Although actually, the song from Hard Day's Night that we played back when we were doing, playing around the pubs as teens, was You Can't Do That, which again we never really got the groove for.
And it's got to be slow.
In later years, I've kind of come to appreciate just how groovy it is, because they don't, the Beatles don't have a lot of like dancey songs, really.
They're ones that when he plays now as well, they really stick out as being not something I would never stick on, but Can't Buy Me Love, All My Loving, like those in a live setting, they just sort of, even with his new like super tight band, they just completely tear the roof off. It's very late. So that was Field Music. What a brilliant episode.
Yeah, it was great. And you know what? Drum rolls that Ringo did, lovely jazzy drum rolls. Mr. Kite, how did we miss that? Anyway, doesn't matter.
Mr. Kite, I was right about, but it was the alternative version on the anthology of Your Mother Should Know, which is almost a bolero with loads of little drum rolls.
And also, I said I'm not such a fan of Can't Buy Me Love. I realised the other day why that was, which was Jeff Lloyd tweeted a video that was on ITV to kind of advertise that anthology at the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's loads of quite weird celebrities.
Incredible selection of 1990s Beatles celebrities.
Yeah, talking about the Beatles, one of whom is Bruce Forsyth, who sings Can't Buy Me Love in this kind of quite show tune way while clicking his fingers.
Sort of swingy Sinatra thing.
Yeah, and I realised whenever I hear Can't Buy Me Love, I can just see Brucey's finger clicks. It's deeply embedded in my mind. And I think
there's also a fantastic bit where Jeremy Beadle says that one of his favourite songs is called I Am a Walrus.
It's great.
Which is superb. Nice. Yeah. So thank you very much for listening.
And Rolf Harris.
And Rolf Harris is in it. And Donald Trump.
So, is he? I didn't get to that bit.
Yeah, he sings a bit of Hey Jude. So
crumbs.
The good and the bad. So we'll be back next week with Shappy Corsandi, which is another really brilliant episode. Yeah, one of my favourite ones we've ever done. So that's a good one. If you didn't listen to the extended version of that, then you missed out on the great story concerning Prince and his love of field music, which is really sort of interesting. And please continue to get in touch.
Bye.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.